There's a famous legal maxim, falsus in uno, falsus in omnibus. Here's prosecutor Mark Gilson explaining this maxim in closing argument at the Willie Vesey trial. It means false in one, false in all. If the witness doesn't tell you the truth about one thing, how can you believe him about anything? They didn't want me to have the time cards. It was obvious, and you know why now, because you have seen them, and you have seen the problems with these time cards. They didn't want me to have them. They weren't going to give them to me. This was the strategy employed by the state at trial. It was the only strategy that the prosecution could have employed because the defense had a time card showing Willie Vesey clocking into work about 4 hours before the Jamaican was fatally shot and not clocking out until about 4 hours after that shooting. But if the prosecution could shoot the messenger and establish that the Houlihan supervisors were circling the wagons to protect their former dishwasher and their employer, they could get a conviction. And they did. The falsus in uno maxim, though, has an ignoble origin. It was first used during the Stuart treason trials of the 17th century, which were plagued by accusations of prosecutorial misconduct, including allegations of suborned perjury. This takes us back to the conviction of Willie Vesey, which was largely based upon the eyewitness identification of Denise Mitchell. In the years since Willie Vesey's conviction, the question has become, what if we apply the falsus in uno maxim to both her identification and the state's own behavior?
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Willie Vesey. This episode is Falsus in Uno. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at the UFML L2, as well as podcast at the 45th, along with Rabia.
In episode 1, we noted that Denise Mitchell initially didn't pick Willie Vesey's picture out of a photo array. It wasn't until months later when she was re-shown a single page of the photo array with Willie Vesey's smack dab in the middle and photos of four darker-skinned men surrounding it that she made her identification. We also noted that, at trial, defense counsel Jules Epstein cross-examined Mitchell about a phone call she made to him before the trial. The call was about Mitchell's glasses needing repair, and Mitchell therefore not wearing them on the night of the shooting. Epstein tried to follow up with Mitchell to track down her eyeglass prescription, but Mitchell became uncooperative. As a result, Epstein was left to take her word at trial when she said her vision was 40 over 100. But this wasn't the only phone call between Mitchell and Epstein. We asked Epstein about a second phone call, but his memory was a bit foggy.
And then there was a second call where, if I'm reading the trial transcript correctly, she called and told you that she could have made a mistake, that she saw a man who looked just like Pee-wee Willie Vesey
the day before. After he had been arrested.
Right. Could you explain that call?
Unfortunately, you just triggered the entirety of my memory of it. But I believe I cross-examined her on that.
Right.
So what was the exact nature of this call? Well, let's look at the trial transcript. Here's the exchange between Epstein and Mitchell.
Question. All right. Now, do you also remember that when I spoke to you on the phone and I asked you some of these questions, you said to me I could have made a mistake. Yesterday, I saw a man who looked just like Pee-wee. Do you remember saying those words to me on July 29th of 1992 when I interviewed you on the phone?
I don't recall that, no. But if you said I said it, then maybe I did, but I don't recall.
Question. Well, do you remember an incident at some time this July after my client had been arrested and locked up that you saw someone on the street who you thought looked like Pee-wee?
Sure.
So, I guess that's pretty good testimony. It seems like Mitchell is saying she saw someone else who looked like Willie, which could mean that this was a case of mistaken identification. But Mitchell is also saying that she doesn't recall making the statement. And then we have this, from redirect examination.
Question. Miss Mitchell, Mr. Epstein asked you a question about a phone conversation you had with him. Was there more than one time that he called you on the phone or just once?
No, plenty of times.
Question. And do you recall telling him on the telephone that you could have made a mistake?
No, okay. I might have.
What did you tell him and why did you tell him that?
I don't remember telling. I told him that my eyesight wasn't good and he was tricking me.
Question, what do you mean by that?
Because I thought he was a good guy.
Question, why do you say the things that you said to him?
So he could stop bothering me.
Question, why didn't you want him to bother you anymore?
Because he's on the opposite side from what I am from. I'm on the defense, the plaintiff's side, and at least he shouldn't have been calling me at all.
Question, did it bother you that he was calling you?
Yeah, after a while, yeah.
Yeah, so this was a pretty big win for the prosecution. At first, it looked like the defense had Denise Mitchell saying she had bad eyesight and might have mistaken Willie Veazey for someone else. But now, she's saying that she only made those statements so the defense counsel would stop peppering her with calls and get off her back. In the end, we doubt these phone calls undermined the state's case at all.
That case, of course, ended in Willie Veazey's conviction in February of 1993. About 7 years later, William Tyson, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, began looking into the case with his students. We haven't been able to track Professor Tyson down, and the only two documents that remain from that investigation are a memo from a student, which addressed the following issue. Was the compensation Denise Mitchell received in exchange for her testimony an act of prosecutorial misconduct, or was it in accordance with the common law prerogative of an attorney offering compensation in exchange for witness testimony? Which is a pretty big WTF memo. And no, we have nothing else in the records that suggests Denise Mitchell is paid. We've reached out to the student with no response, so we don't know what the origin of the memo was, if it was a hypothetical exercise, or if it suggests that their investigation found some evidence that we don't have record of.
Holidays are just around the corner, and I'll be honest, it's one of my favorite times of the year, if it wasn't for the fact that it's also one of the busiest times of the year. And one of the things that adds to that busyness is, well, having to go shopping and sending out all those gifts and cards for family, friends, and loved ones, which we love to do, but does take up a lot of your time. And that's why Stamps.com this year can help you save all that time, because you know what? You're not going to have time to go to the post office with everything you have to do. Plus, do you know what the post office looks like during the holiday season? Just tons and tons of lines, hundreds of people trying to get their holiday greetings and gifts and cards out. So you know what? Use Stamps.com instead. Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer, and then the mailman will pick it up. Now, there's lots of reasons for you to use Stamps.com instead of going to the post office. Number one, because you're so busy. Number two, because the post office is too busy. And for some folks, it's simply too hard to get out and about, like my own parents who are elderly, and it's way too difficult for them to go and stand in line at the post office. But if they're able to send their gifts and cards out to their family and friends, to their grandkids, to everybody they need to reach during the holiday season without having to leave their house, imagine how much easier their lives will be. And Stamps.com sends you a digital scale, so, you know, you can automatically calculate your exact postage. You don't have to go and get your stuff weighed. They even help you decide the best class of mail every time, so there is no confusion. Now, right now, you guys can enjoy Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. And think about not just your own convenience, but the convenience of people in your life for who it's kind of hard to get out and about. And maybe help them get Stamps.com too. So once again, go to Stamps.com and enter undisclosed to get this great offer. That's Stamps.com and enter undisclosed.
And the second document, the other one from Professor Tyson's investigation, is an affidavit by Denise Mitchell, dated November 10th, 2001. It states the following. I, Denise Mitchell, state that all the following statements are true and correct to the best of my knowledge, information, and belief. I testified at the trial of Willie Veazey, Pee-wee, in February 1993. He was on trial for the homicide of John Lewis, Jamaica, and the shooting and robbery of Gonzalez, a drug dealer, in January 1992. At this trial, I said that from my window at 714 Russell Street in Philadelphia, I saw Pee-wee shoot Gonzalez. At the time, I honestly believed that Pee-wee was there and that he shot Gonzalez. Since that time, I realized that I made a mistake in saying Pee-wee was there and he was the shooter. I knew Pee-wee from the neighborhood, and I thought he was cute. The person that I saw shoot Gonzalez was cute and looked like Pee-wee. That is why I thought Pee-wee was the shooter. My vision is very poor, and I am virtually legally blind. My vision was like this at the time of the crime. I have the paperwork to prove this. The crime occurred when it was dark, at a distance from my window, and I did not have my glasses on. Several times since the crime, I have seen, with my poor vision, several men that are cute that look like Pee-wee. Before the trial, I told Pee-wee's lawyer, Jules Epstein, that I could have made a mistake in telling the police that Pee-wee was the shooter and that I had recently seen a man who looked just like Pee-wee. Therefore, by this affidavit, I am recanting the testimony that I gave at Pee-wee's trial, that Pee-wee shot Gonzalez. Pee-wee did not shoot Gonzalez, and he was not at the crime scene. I have not been pressured in any way to make this affidavit. I feel bad that I have not come forward sooner, but I never wanted to be involved in this. I was confused, poor, and did not know what to do. I was afraid to go to the police or the DA. I have told several people in the neighborhood that I made a mistake in saying Pee-wee was the shooter. Recently, Mike Veazey, Pee-wee's nephew, ran into me. He had just gotten out of jail. He knew I had testified against Pee-wee, and that I had told people that I made a mistake in saying Pee-wee was involved in the shooting of Gonzalez. He asked me if I would be willing to talk to a lawyer about the matter. I said yes. William Tyson, who is a full-time professor at the University of Pennsylvania and a lawyer, eventually contacted me. He runs a prison clinic at the law school and has been working with his students on Pee-wee's case. He said he has also spoken with Jules Epstein. Mr. Tyson told me that Mr. Epstein thinks that Pee-wee is absolutely innocent, and that he wakes up at night thinking about the fact that an innocent man is in jail for life. The same thing often happens to me. I told Mr. Tyson about my mistake, and he prepared this affidavit for my signature.
Yeah, I mean, this is, when you read it, something you might expect to see in a movie or a TV show, and this is the climax of the episode or the movie, and this is what leads to Willie Veazey being released. And, I mean, you look at it, this is the only eyewitness who's identified Veazey, and she is recanting and saying, I'm legally blind, I made a mistake. What did you two think when you first saw this document?
I'm, by the way, legally blind. When I was like around 17 years old when I was told that I am legally blind. And yeah, if I look at somebody at 40 feet, I cannot at all make out. I know it's a person. I can tell you very general things like height and obviously like kind of maybe skin tone, but I could not at all distinguish a single feature on their face at all. So it is a big, big difference in the vision she testified to having versus what she actually has, legal blindness. There's no way she could have identified Willie Veazey from that distance.
I hate that I'm so cynical now, but a witness recanting is meaningless. And I'll clarify, not meaningless in that, but in terms of the legal system, in terms of appellate and post-conviction motions, they don't care.
We're seeing this really interesting thing where, I mean, in a lot of courts, when a witness recants, the court finds that as another strike against her credibility. Well, you lied before, so maybe you're lying now. And you would think in a case like this, especially where there is literally no other evidence against this poor man, including actual evidence of innocence, like his time card, this would weigh heavily in his favor. And this was like 2001. That's a long time ago. But it's pretty shocking to the conscience. But like Susan said, it's not a surprise anymore.
Yeah, and to that point, Robbie, that is sort of the title of this episode, this maxim, falsus in uno, which you often see a prosecutor at trial saying, usually to attack defense witnesses and say, well, they lied about one thing, they must be lying about everything. And it's odd because we get to the point where the person's being convicted and this witness who incriminated the defendant is now saying, I lied. And the court's saying, well, we can't trust that. But then why don't we apply that same maxim to their trial testimony, their identification, and say, well, we also couldn't trust that. And if that's what the conviction was based upon, we have to throw it out.
Well, think of the jailhouse snitches in Joy's case. They, before trial, recanted and said, no, I made it up when I told the people at the jail that Joey confessed to me. And that was used as proof that they're lying about the confession. But the confession itself that they reported, that part's clearly true still.
Yeah, and so let's go ahead and sort of break down the specifics of that affidavit. So the first point, obviously, is at trial, we know Denise Mitchell claimed her vision was 40 over 100. And again, that means that if an object or a person is 40 feet away, that appears to the person with the nearsightedness to be 100 feet away. Well, legally blind, the definition of that is it starts at 40 over 400. So that means the objects or people that are 40 feet away actually appear to be 400 or more feet away. And that's a pretty huge difference, because at 40 over 100, you know, you might conceive that Denise Mitchell could have seen Willie Vesey and somehow made out his facial features, even though it's dark. It's a tough sell, but it's a sell. But at 40 over 400, that's basically Denise Mitchell seeing a blob and having no idea who this person is. And the second take-home from this affidavit is, as Jim Fogorski of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project noted, this affidavit kind of lines up with the testimony given at trial by Denise's brother, Chucky King.
It was more or less a recantation. It was where, you know, Denise agreed that she had poor vision and that she really couldn't see, and she said that she's legally blind, and that she now believes that she made the wrong choice in saying it was Pee-wee, Willie Vesey. And her own brother seems to back that up at trial. Her brother's Chucky King. And Chucky King testified for Mr. Vesey as a defense witness at trial and told the court that, in so many words, that there was another Pee-wee who did it. It wasn't that Pee-wee.
So legally speaking, what happened with Denise Mitchell's affidavit? Well, if you listen to our series in the Jamar Huggins case, you might recall that most courts don't look too kindly at recantations, as we just discussed. And here's Jules Epstein again.
Unfortunately, in Pennsylvania, and it may be true elsewhere, witness recantation, even though sometimes they're true, they're tremendously disfavored by our courts.
Right.
Now, obviously, any particular judge could say, I believe it. But the law says it's entirely up to the judge. And the truth is that what happens is most judges say, nah, why didn't you say that back then?
Right.
You know, probably some member of the defendant's family got to you. That's at least, if you will, a prevailing belief.
Beyond Epstein's point, though, it's important to note that Willie Vesey's appeal didn't really turn on this legal inertia. Like in the Jamar Huggins appeal, it tuned in on whether the recantation of the state star witness constituted, quote, new or, quote, after discovered evidence. And here's what the Superior Court of Pennsylvania had to say about this issue. Indeed, Mitchell alleges in the statement that before the trial, I told Vesey's lawyer, Jules Epstein, that I could have made a mistake in telling the police that Vesey was a shooter and that I had recently seen a man who looked just like Vesey. Vesey had ample opportunity to explore Mitchell's alleged misgivings before trial and cross-examine her concerning them during the trial. Accordingly, we find that the after-discovered evidence exception does not apply, and therefore, Vesey's second PCRA petition was untimely. The court is, of course, correct that the defense had notice of Denise Mitchell's misgivings and the chance to explore those misgivings both before and at trial. But you've heard from Jules Epstein about this. Denise Mitchell told him about her vision issues, but then blew him off when he tried to get information about her eye doctor. And as a result, he had to rely on her claim that her vision was 40 over 100 at trial, when the truth now seems that it was much, much worse.
And Epstein did get Mitchell to reluctantly admit that she called him and said she saw someone who looked just like Pee-wee, but she later testified on redirect that she only said this to placate him and stop his pestering and get him to leave her alone. But Mitchell's post-trial affidavit indicates that on her own, she started telling people that she felt bad about her testimony at Vesey's trial and that she knew she'd identified the wrong man. This seems like fundamentally new evidence that Epstein couldn't have coaxed out of her at trial. Here's how Willie sees it.
Do you have any thoughts on why Denise Mitchell testified against you? Do you think it was an honest mistake?
That's exactly what I think it was, an honest mistake. There's no other reasons. There could be no other reason that she made an honest mistake. You know, and the thing, if she knew she made an honest mistake, why would she, you know, stay with that, you know? If she wasn't 100% sure, and you can't be 100% right that it was me, you know? So, I don't know why she would stick with that statement.
You spend one-third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable. Casper brand mattresses combine multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. And their breathable design helps you sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night. Casper mattresses are designed, developed, and assembled all in the US. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars across Casper, Amazon, and Google, Casper is quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. And Casper isn't just a mattress company. They offer a wide array of products to ensure an overall better sleep experience. And they have affordable prices because Casper cuts out the middleman and sells directly to the consumer. And they have no hassle returns if you're not completely satisfied. To be specific, you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep on it trial. And I've got to say, I've been using Casper for a little over a year now, and it's the best mattress I've ever owned. It really helps me sleep throughout the night, and I feel so good and refreshed when I wake up in the morning. And now you too can sleep ahead of the curve with the Casper. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/undisclosed and using the promo code undisclosed at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. That's casper.com/undisclosed and use the promo code undisclosed at checkout.
And Denise Mitchell apparently isn't the only person who now claims to know that Willie Veazey is innocent.
In episode 3, I talked to Seth Schramm, the back-of-the-house manager at the Houlihan's where Willie Veazey worked as a dishwasher in January 1992. After we talked about Willie's alibi, Schramm dropped a bombshell on me. As we noted last episode, a number of the kitchen employees at Houlihan's, including Willie Veazey, lived in the same part of North Philadelphia and would take the 55 bus to and from work.
There were a bunch of them that knew Willie didn't do it, but they were all saying they were afraid to say anything because of what could have happened to them, because they did know who did it.
Oh, wow. Do you remember any of the names of them?
Yeah, I don't know where they are, though. I can tell you one name, a guy named James Miller, Jimmy Miller. His name, we called him Jim the Lover. I don't know where he is or anything. He knew. I can get some other names as well.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I actually one of my teachers here worked with me at Houlihan's back in the 80s, in the early 90s, and was around during that time as well.
Okay.
You could talk to him about what I'm saying. He was an assistant chef there.
Okay. Sure.
But Timmy, I can't remember Timmy's last name. I gave his name. You know, Gump, Mark Gump Griffin. Gump is his street name, his nickname. You know. And I believe Richard Lee. As well. Jim Miller, I definitely know.
So that's James Miller, a.k.a. Jimmy the Lover, Richard Lee, Mark Griffin, a.k.a. Gump, and Timmy, last name unknown. They all worked at the Jenkintown Houlihan's in the early 90s, and they might have the information that can set Willie Veazey free. I asked Willie about these men.
Yeah, well, when I talked to Seth Schramm, he said that after you were arrested, there were a number of guys in the kitchen who sort of lived in the general area who knew you didn't do it and knew the person who did it but were afraid to talk.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm trying.
That's a shocker to me. Yeah, that is a total shocker to me. You knew who did it. I mean, I don't know. I guess, you know, guys still live by that code, man. You know, don't tell. I mean, I don't get that. I didn't come from that world.
Yeah.
You know, if you knew someone else that didn't do it, you knew who did it, why would you let an innocent man go to prison, you know?
Yeah. Some of the names he mentioned, I don't know if any of these ring a bell. One was James Miller, who he said went by Jim the Lover. There was another guy, Mark Griffith, who went by Gump, and another guy named Richard Lee. Did any of those names ring a bell?
The name Gump, though. Uh-huh. That's about that name Gump, dude. Yeah, that kind of rang a bell.
Needless to say, we've been following up on this information and trying to track down these men, but we haven't been successful, at least at this point. But this isn't Willie's only possible avenue for relief.
Our journey to Willie's case is an interesting one. We started talking to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project last fall when they brought us the Sean Thomas case, which I reported on in September. That case ended both with the conviction review unit throwing out Sean's conviction and with some previously undisclosed files being turned over. Apparently, those files had information that wasn't only important to Sean's case. The files also contained vital information in the Willie Veazey case. And this has led to a new appeal being filed for Willie. But it's been filed under seal. And what this means is that we're now in the same position that you're all in regarding the bombshells in Adnan's case. In the dark. What we know is the state failed to disclose some key information about who might have killed the Jamaican. And we know that there's some evidence that further calls into question Denise Mitchell's testimony. But that's it. We had hoped the seal would have been lifted before the end of our series on Willie's case, and maybe it will by the time we record next week's addendum. But as of right now, we don't know. What we were finally able to do was talk to Willie. And you've heard a few parts of the call in the last two episodes. But here's a bit more. We started by asking Willie to describe a typical day in prison.
Pretty much, you know, I get up every go on the block that I live on, go to breakfast. I normally go on daily day passes. During the afternoons, I go to class, school. And pretty much after that, after school is over, I come back, be in the cell, probably reading or painting or doing things like that. And pretty much that's about it. That's really like a day-to-day basis, 7 days a week.
Specifically, Willie told us he's close to getting his GED.
Right now I'm in a GED class. And I think I just have two left. I have science to do and history. And that's normally, that's 5 days a week from 2:30 to 3:45. So normally I'll come back from there, study for like maybe an hour or so to about maybe 5 o'clock. Count clears around five, then they start running their evening meal. I run that till about maybe 5:30, 5:35. We lock back up till 6 o'clock till line movement. From line movement, they start running passes to other programs and activities and things of that nature. After that is over, then they normally, the blocks have like a block out where everybody get to come out, get on the phone, use the kiosk machines or play games or whatever they normally do. Until about 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock is lock up and everybody's in for the night, to the next morning.
But art is Willie's true passion. We played this clip before, but here's Marissa Bluestein, the director of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project.
He is earnest and thoughtful. He's a marvelous artist. We actually have quite a little war going on in our office over his artwork because I refuse to bring it from home to the office where it's supposed to be, but I like it where it is.
According to Willie, his passion for painting is largely something he picked up in prison.
I picked up painting about 3 years ago. I was doing artwork as far as like greeting cards and stuff like that, like maybe 10 years ago. So I pretty much stopped doing that and I pretty much, you know, focused more on doing paintings and things like that.
We took Willie back to 1992 and his life a quarter of a century ago. And as we noted in the last episode, things were going well for him before his arrest. He was hired at Houlihan's the dishwasher, but quickly gained a promotion to expediter.
What did that job entail?
That job included me, I would come in the morning, sometimes I would come in the mornings. I would set up the line, I would set up the whole line. I would take the wheel, the mic, and I would call in all the orders from the prompter machine to all the cooks. And like most of the time, when it get really crowded, I would call the manager to the line and I would go back there and help the cooks prepare the food. But it was my job to set the line up and keep the line set up. You know, I mean, keep it full with everything because like I said, on the weekends, I mean, the weekends it really, really gets crowded in there. So that was mainly my job right there as expediter.
And things were also going well in Willie's family life. In episode two, we played some audio from our interview with Willie's sister, Keitra, who talked about her special bond with her brother. And Willie felt the same way.
She was my little sister. I never had a little sister. I only have two sisters. I have an older sister and I have her. So my mom pretty much counted on me to take her to school 5 days a week. I would take her to school in the morning and I actually would ride my bike and take her to school and I would pick her up again around 3-4 o'clock. You know, so a lot of that time, you know, and most of it, I changed her diaper a lot. My older sister, she did the cooking for us, you know, and I did the cleaning and taking care of her, my little sister. That's why we're so close. I pretty much did everything for her, just about. It's just like the first time you always wanted a little brother, always wanted a little sister.
Yeah.
And I got that.
But everything that Willie had been building in early 1992 was quickly torn down on the morning of June 9th.
I just came in the house about between 4 and 4:30 that morning because I was out with a friend. And we was doing a lot of drinking because of this boy's birthday. Remember coming in the house, and I went to go find something to eat. And I sat down, tried to play video games during that time, but that wasn't happening. So I left and went upstairs, took my shoes off, and I pretty much flopped right in the bed because I was, like, heavy intoxicated. I remember getting up to go to the bathroom, and I guess it was about maybe something around 6 o'clock, and I heard all this noise and all this commotion going on. So by the time I finished, I stepped out of the bathroom and I looked to the right down the steps, and I seen a whole lot of officers in tactical gear coming up the steps, and they asked me my name. And I said, Pee-wee. And they said, that's him. So I started backing up. I backed into the bathroom. One of the officers pushed me down in the bathtub, turned me over, put the handcuffs on me, pulled me out of there, walked down the steps. My little sister came out of the room, and she had her little night clothes on. She was just standing there looking at me. And I just, they took me, they escorted me down the stairs. Once they went outside, I seen my mother and my stepfather. They had both of them on their knees facing each other with handcuffs on. And my mother asked me, what did I do? I said, I don't know. And they escorted me down the street into a van. She called down to ask him, could he put his shoes on? They put me in the van, left me there. A couple of minutes, they came back with a pair of shoes. And from there, they took me down to 8th and Race.
Science tells us that there are 5 stages of sleep, but if I'm going to be honest, I got to tell you, it's hard for me to reach any one of them because I have been a lifelong, very light sleeper. It's hard for me to get to sleep and it's hard for me to stay asleep. So I'm always on the lookout for the most comfortable bedding and sheets ever because that's what's going to help me sleep. Because you know what? If you want a good night's sleep, well, the 3 most important words are comfort, comfort, comfort. And I found that comfort with Bold & Branch. They have the most amazing sheets ever, and they're more affordable than you think. Now, what makes them unique is that each sheet is crafted from 100% organic cotton. That means they don't only feel incredible, but Bowl & Branch sheets are also beautiful. They look amazing. And since Bowl & Branch sells exclusively online, you don't pay that expensive retail markup. That is half the price for twice the quality. You will love these sheets, and you can try them for 30 nights and see for yourself. If you're not impressed, return them for a full refund. Think about that. You get to sleep on these sheets for 30 nights, and if you don't like them, give them back. But you know what? Everybody who sleeps on Bowl & Branch sheets loves them, and nobody returns them. And that's why they have thousands of 5-star reviews. The New York Times, Forbes, and the Wall Street Journal rave about them, and even 3 U.S. presidents have Bowl & Branch sheets. So go to bowlandbranch.com today, and you're going to get $50 off your first set of sheets, plus free shipping in the U.S. when you use the promo code UNDISCLOSED. That's $50 off, plus free U.S. shipping right now at bowlandbranch.com. It's B-O-L-L and branch.com, and the promo code is undisclosed. So don't miss this great offer. BowlandBranch.com, promo code undisclosed.
Now, we didn't talk with Willie about his interrogation and his confession in this case. Of course, you might say this was the most important part of his case, but Willie had an extreme reaction after Jim Tranum revisited that part of the case with Willie and the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and we agreed it wasn't in Willie's best interest, both short-term and long-term, to reopen those old wounds. But we did talk with Willie about the victim in this case, John Lewis.
John, Jay Jamaica, I knew him. We hung out a lot. Yeah, we hung out a lot during the week, him and a couple other guys of us that live around in that area.
And so you were friendly with him?
Yeah.
What was he like?
Yes, I was. He was a real cool guy. He was sort of like me, you know, a laid-back person. You know, we did a lot of fun things, you know, as far as we shot pool, we went out to little parties and stuff like that. You know, we hung out and had fun. That's basically what it was.
Given this, we asked how shocked he was when he was convicted at trial for killing a friend, especially in light of the alibi that he had.
I was totally shocked when that happened, when he came back with a second-degree conviction. I was totally shocked at that. I didn't know what to do. Didn't know what to do, didn't know what to say. It was unbelievable. After the trial was over, you know, I was thinking maybe if I would have took the stand to explain my situation, what happened that morning in the investigation room, maybe that might have been a different outcome. I don't know. You know, I don't know how much of the law they actually knew at the time, you know, what type of instruction they was given. You know what I'm saying? I really knew anything about the law during that time.
Right.
Can we ask why you didn't take the stand? Was that your own decision? Was that something you were advised not to do?
I was advised not to do that by my attorney. He didn't want me to take the stand. He felt as though I guess I wasn't ready to take the stand. So, you know, I took his advice.
And then there's the question you'd probably want to ask of anyone who you feel has been wrongfully convicted.
I mean, how difficult has it been for you? I mean, it's been 25 years now, knowing that you're in prison for a crime you didn't commit.
I mean, it's been hard, you know. Every day I find a reason to wake up and, you know, go on with life, you know, and hope and pray that, you know, something comes up and happens where I can get out of here, you know. But, you know, there's a lot of good guys in here that I surround myself with, you know, that's positive, you know, that's in the same position I'm in with doing, you know, a life sentence, you know, so that helps a lot.
It's been tough on Willie's family, too. Here's his stepfather, Arnold Morrell.
She's got up in age now. She'd like to have some home.
Right.
She'd like to have us at home. But mother don't like to have us at home.
Right.
She suffers a lot.
Right.
Suffers a lot. I'm right now, she's starting to forget a lot as she got older. She's worried about her son. You know, she already lost one son at an early age, but behind polio. I get upset when I used to talk about Mr. Miller. And I put my hand on the Bible. And you picked before the judge, and I swear before the judge, Piggy didn't do that.
And then there's his baby sister, Keitra, now a 37-year-old mother.
His spirit has always been good. He always told me, he said, Keitra, he said, you're my baby sister. He said, the only reason why I'm still living is because of you. And I never understood what he meant by that. And he explained it to me. He says, the only reason is because of you. And I just talked to him, and I try to keep his spirits up in spite of everything that I'm going through. You know, he said, if I ever come home, the first thing I want to do, he was like, I want to go to get my blood checked. And I said, why? He was like, because I want to see if I'm a match for you. I want to donate my kidney to you. You know? That's my big brother. That's my heart. When he cried, I feel his pride. When he in pain, I feel his pain. And it's like, he's like my other hand for my ribs. Like, I don't, my brother.
And finally, his mother, Bonnie.
Oh gosh, it's been so long. I've just been doing with my son and looking at him when I see him feeling bad because he's in there for something I don't believe that he did.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't. You can't make me believe that because I don't think so. Because he had a job. He used to go to work and he'd get off late at night. And he'd come home. He might go see some of your girl he was talking to, but by him working so late, he mostly came on home and just, you know, went out during the day and see his girlfriend and different friends of his. But he was an outgoing guy. He loved people.
Right. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk with me. We're working with the Innocence Project in Pennsylvania. We have some new evidence, and, you know, we're hoping. You never know.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. Now, that would be the best thing in the world.
Yeah. We'll see if it's enough, but we're still working on it. We're going to do whatever we can, and, you know, hopefully we'll be able to bring your son home, but we'll see.
Thank you. Oh, gosh. I really hope you can do this, because he deserved to be home with his family.
Right.
Oh, Lord. I'm just waiting till the day comes that he does come home. I won't. I just hold my breath.
As Morgan Freeman said in The Shawshank Redemption, hope is a good thing, maybe the best of things, and no good thing ever dies. But hope can be dangerous, too. For every John Thomas, there's Jamar Huggins, with evidence that seems to prove his innocence, and a family that desperately wants him to return home, but no relief, at least not yet. But there's reason to hope. There's Willie's new appeal, which we promised to report on once the seal's been lifted. And the same conviction review unit that threw out John Thomas's conviction based upon a strong alibi is now reviewing Willie's case. And last week, Philadelphia elected progressive district attorney Larry Krasner, a former guest on the show, who has promised to look into Philadelphia cases of possible wrongful convictions. There's no telling where any of this will lead, but we can tell you that wherever Willie's case goes, we'll continue to follow it and report what happens to you.
A big, big thank you to everybody who made this very important series possible. I have to begin by thanking the folks at the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, Marissa, Riley, Jim. You guys do amazing work, your entire teams. Thank you to Mital Delhan as our executive producer. Thanks for keeping us going. Baluki, thank you so much for designing our logo. A big thanks to Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. Thank you to all of our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. Audio production is done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media, and she is the host of one of my favorite podcasts, by the way, Crime Writers On, and a new podcast called AGTV and Me. Definitely check it out. Don't forget to send any questions you have to us over Twitter and use the hashtag UDAddendum. And don't forget to follow us online on all our social media. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.